The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. Some disillusioned college students pretty well phrased about what most people are thinking about today. Will there be a world tomorrow? Will there be a peaceful world to bring up your children in the next couple of decades, or are we going to blast ourselves off the face of the earth? What they had to say that was printed in a newspaper in the city of, up at Salt Lake City in Utah, is interesting enough to report it to you. They said the hard facts of history have repeatedly demonstrated that peace is a sterile myth. What right does one have to be optimistic for world brotherhood when there is no evidence of increased understanding? We are convinced, these disillusioned college students wrote, that the world is presently on a doomsday course and that our destiny is total annihilation. Sounds like they've been reading something from Sir Bertrand Russell or others. They're already convinced. Now, maybe you're not, but at least this is what some college students who are studying all the various classes in college, geopolitics and civics and humanities and all the various subjects about mankind, from history to modern international relations between countries and great political powers. And they had to come to the conviction, they said, we're convinced that the world is presently on a doomsday course and that our destiny is total annihilation. This assumption is not based upon theory or doctrine, which in good part is causing much of the problem, but on simple observation and historical evidence. It is hard for us, they said, looking forward to the good life, to think in terms of nothingness or even to want to. Don't expect education to solve our problem, they wrote. Education has made the whole matter of universal destruction a likely and grotesque probability. Any solution for those who accept this unlikely possibility will be a grassroots solution that takes place on a global basis and in the hearts of men. But who is to change the hearts of men? They said it is our prejudices, our biases, our hates, and our selfishnesses that keep the fires of dissension smoldering at molten levels. And then they concluded the horsemen of the apocalypse have far outrun the horsemen of peace. We hope we are wrong. But are they wrong or are they right? That's the biggest question of this age, isn't it? It's the biggest question confronting man in general today. Are these students wrong or are they right? Are we on a doomsday course? Are we headed toward world annihilation? Or are we on the threshold of a breakthrough into an age beyond a greater, more wonderful utopian era than man has ever known? Some tell you one thing, some tell you another. It seems those who have the most facts at their disposal seem to be the most disillusioned. And it seems the more facts you get at your disposal, the more information you obtain, the more disillusioned people become. But on the other hand are thinkers who simply theorize. And they theorize about the goodness of man, about all of the brotherhood of man, about all of these time-honored and shop-worn cliches that have been used by everybody from local clubs to great governments, from as far back in history as you can remember, of equality and freedom and brotherhood and mutual love and peace with justice and all of the statements that we have hung our hopes upon for so long. Then there are those who look at weather, who look at politics, who look at religion, who look at the population explosion, who look at the tremendous change between and among races, who look at vast and growing disparity between the have and the have-not nations, who look at the potential number of nations to control nuclear weapons in the next 10 years, 40 of them perhaps, before too much longer, and they amass facts and they look at statistics, and the more they look, the more frightened they become, until a lot of times people get a few statistics and facts about the real world situation, and then they just quit looking at the facts anymore because they're so frightening. So it pretty well boils down to, what would you like to believe? Now, those students said they hope they are wrong. Well, they are. They are wrong. Man is going to survive, all right, but he's going to survive because there is a great overall plan. There is a great overall master plan for the world that lies beyond us, for the age ahead of us, for the world tomorrow, that most people have never heard of. They have turned away from, they didn't know that's what it said, because they thought that it was just a first century religion. I'm referring to the Bible. I'm referring to the gospel that was brought to this earth nearly 2,000 years ago, for an age beyond, an overall program and plan for the rehabilitation of mankind and all of his societies. A program for the salvation. I don't mean the afterlife alone. I mean the saving of physical lives and the salvation of man materially as well. I mean saving man from himself and ensuring we're going to have a future on this earth. That great master plan for the salvation of the human race was brought to this earth nearly 2,000 years ago. But it's been ignored and scoffed at and rejected of man almost ever since. Oh, I don't mean the person of Christ. People talk about the person of Christ. But how much do you know about the message Christ brought? About a government that is going to rule on this earth? About the great capital city he spoke of? About how all of the various departments of government are going to be combined in one great supranational world-ruling government? Executive, legislative, judiciary, a tremendous worldwide police force, more effective than any the world has ever known. Complete abolition of crime. Complete and total worldwide compulsory education. Complete and total worldwide agrarian reform. Such vast economic reforms your mind, you can hardly imagine. This master plan of God. But it's there. It's in the Bible. He even talks about one world language, one world calendar at last. How all races and peoples are going to count time the same way. It'll be the same year in Saudi Arabia as it is in China, and the same year in China as it will be in America in those days. That's what the Bible claims. It says that it has such a plan. Now, you may not know this about the Bible. You may think the Bible is just mythology or history or a collection of all kinds of weird books that are difficult to understand. Well, why do you think this? Well, if you're like a lot of people I've talked to, you think this because you've never read it. But now, does this make sense? You think something because you've never looked into something? We got a letter from a woman in England not long ago that said, now, I know practically nothing about the prehistory of man, but I have some very concrete conclusions on the subject. And I thought, well, do you have such concrete conclusions on every subject about which you admittedly know so little? You see, most people have not looked into the Bible very much for themselves. They've been willing to take other people's opinions about the Bible. They assume that somewhere, somehow, there must be a lot of people who have really put the Bible to the test. And they must be great, intelligent people, intellectual people, educated people. And they've written books and documents and articles, and they've had their works published in national magazines about how the Bible is fraught with all kinds of sort of shop-worn myths and torn fabric and partial truths and an attempt of a race to aggrandize itself. And they say, well, I'm sure glad I found out about that Bible. I'm sure glad I found out. I can't trust what it says. Now, is this your experience? Have you looked into it for yourself? The chances are you haven't. You might not know that one-third of the Bible is prophecy. And you might not know that the Bible is the most up-to-the-minute book there is. That it talks about this precise moment in history. You might not have ever taken the trouble to prove to yourself whether the Bible is absolute inspiration or mythology, whether it is absolute factual statistical evidence from history and prophecy about the future, or just so much empty myth and empty kind of a faith that is based upon nothing. Now, what is faith? What is the truth? How do you arrive at it? When it has to do with the realm of philosophical or spiritual thinking, a lot of people use a real backward method to attempt to arrive at some truth. How do you arrive at the truth, at the proof, at the facts? When it has to do with a spiritual principle, there is one thing you cannot do. You can't give birth to a brain child and then sit around and toy with it, play with it, mull it over, and then use such expressions as these. You know, I am coming more and more to feel, or I think that, I surmise that, I suppose, I postulate, I guess, I suspect that, or I am coming to believe more and more. This is what so many people do. They say, now, you know what I think? I think this, and then they toy with it. And they take the idea to bed with them, and they rise up in the morning, and they mull it over breakfast, toast, and coffee, and they walk and talk and think about it, and they keep thinking. Now, as their brain child grows, they will not admit any evidence anymore against it because now they're beyond that state. No longer are they seeking any objectivity. Only thoughts and compulsions and desires which will support their brain child because it's theirs.
It's part of their empirical selves. It's like a person screaming his head off for his favorite basketball team. It's an extension of yourself. It's like the fellow who snaps his fingers or dances around on one foot or clenches his fist when the ball, which has already left his hand, finally strikes the pins and he knocks them all down at once. It's as if it's an extension of the power of the person. It's one of these things of our environment that we take rather personally. It's our clothes, our home, our car, our wife, our idea. And it's a part of us, we think. And so we will not admit anything as evidence against it. So people lose their objectivity. Now, there has been quite a furor over an idea that Jesus Christ of Nazareth was not really dead at all. And that what happened was, when they handed him that sponge, it was a kind of a conspiratorial effort to cause his pulse to disappear by some kind of a strange drug which so slowed down body metabolism that they thought he was dead, and they took him away secretively and pretended to bury him, but he came back to life later, lived out his life in obscurity someplace, and perhaps died and was buried. This is what people think. Now, on that Christ was alive in the tomb theory, somebody, somewhere, somehow, decided that sounds like a logical thought. Now, what if there was a certain repressant in that sponge that could have done that to Jesus? And then they began thinking and mulling it over. This became a brainchild. Now, I think books and documents and articles have been written on it, and people are talking about it all the time. Now, first of all, let's ask ourselves, why is it people don't want to believe Christ is alive today? Well, first and foremost, because it's embarrassing. First and foremost, because the Bible itself says the carnal mind is enmity against God. It does not like to retain the knowledge of God in its thought, in its business, its home, its family, its daily activities, because that is embarrassing. Primarily, the reason it's embarrassing is because Jesus Christ was a perfect individual, because he claimed he was the literal Son of God, and because in his own statement, written faithfully in the Bible, he claims he's going to return again and take up the reins of government, and he's going to tell people how to live whether they like it or not. And primarily because people do not want to obey God, and they don't want to acknowledge Christ as their boss, as their ruler. They don't want to say, yes, Lord, yes, sir, yes, master, I will. They want to say, you keep your nose out of my business, but give me all your blessings and benefits and rewards. Now, perversely, people reason that way. It's like, maybe you read about General Patton, who, when he went to see General Pershing before he took off for Operation Torch to conduct the landings of the Americans at Casablanca and in North Africa during World War II, he was asked by General Pershing, now very, very aged, to kneel. And General Pershing said, may God bless and keep you, my boy. They stood up and saluted each other, and General Patton wrote later that he thought 25 years dropped from General Pershing. Here was a man who was notorious for his profanity, a man who was notorious for his attitude, and the kind of a general that he was that so aided and helped the United States military cause in World War II. Yet here was a man who, in a moment of tremendous crisis, was able to drop to his knees and receive a blessing from another aged general who had been instrumental in American successes abroad. Rather something to that, perhaps, in history. Strange, isn't it, how people who do not like to retain God in their knowledge when they're out on their own, yet in time of critical stress and crisis, whether it's Eddie Rickenbacker floating helplessly and aimlessly in a lifeboat at sea, or whether it's someone falling off a bridge or down a well or down a coal shaft, or whether it's someone locked in a closet or someone being attacked criminally or something else, they will call out to God. They turn to God. They want God to help them. It's a perverseness of human nature that it wants God to keep nose out of its business while it is comfortable. While you can sit in your easy chair before your TV set, or while you can be comparatively free from aches and pains, cuts and bruises, financial calamity, bad weather, ruined crops, or divorce, or some wretchedness in the family, or some terrible mental turmoil, or some physical debility, as long as you can be comparatively free from these things, you want God to keep his nose out of your business. Yet you want all of his benefits, all of his blessings. You don't acknowledge they're his, maybe. Some people don't. But let's just look at that just for a moment before we continue. Remember now, regardless as to whether you believe in God or not, you'll have to agree that the really important things to you in your life lie in the moral, spiritual, and not the material, but the moral and spiritual realm. In other words, your mental stability. You know that giant complex of brown, ugly buildings just before you get onto the Triborough Bridge heading from LaGuardia into Manhattan, if you've driven over it any time in your life? That giant complex of buildings where you look right through and see all the bars and the people wandering aimlessly, that tremendous big mental hospital, and you think that every other hospital bed in the United States, this great have nation, this nation where 6% of the population of the world enjoys 50% of its wealth, yes, the United States, that every other hospital bed is occupied by somebody who is off his rocker, a poor, mentally afflicted person, somebody who is in various stages of insanity, who is incapable to care for himself, to function normally as a normal citizen and part of society. You think mental stability and balance isn't important? You bet it is, and all too few people have it. How are you going to buy it? Where are you going to go to get it? That's in the spiritual realm. What about your peace of mind, your sense of confidence, your sense of happiness, well-being, and fulfillment, your conscience, your bodily health? You can buy these things, can you? People are attempting to fiddle with them, and they don't know what they're doing. I read where a Western singer has been arrested with a pack of pills in his pocket because he either wants to get a lift or a repressant. So we're going around trying to do things to our mind and body that violate laws, and we're going to pay the penalty as long as we do them. Now, none of these things of happiness and fulfillment, of confidence and a clean conscience and a sense of well-being can be bought, though I know the artificial kind that people seek. By escapism through drugs and alcoholism that you read about so much, becoming a tremendous public health problem right now in our modern so-called up-to-the-moment nations. But none of the real things that you desire, the things that are really important to you in your life, can be bought, and yet every last one of them are regulated by definite spiritual laws and principles. So it's kind of a perverseness of human nature to want God to keep his nose out of your business and still want all the blessings that God can give you in the heavenly realm. Now, you may not admit these things come from God, and that's a little bit irrelevant, because if we, as a majority, all of us, every human being on the face of the earth, were to unite together in atheism and begin to say we don't believe God exists, God is not going to conveniently step out of existence because we think he doesn't exist. There has never yet been a human being who has ever lived who was able to toy with a brainchild and to postulate or to theorize and to come up with some empty-headed speculation and then to cause some tangible thing, some moral principle, some spiritual law, or some factual collection of material knowledge to disappear or conveniently become not so. You can't sit around and theorize with your mind and cause substance to disappear. So some theorize Christ was alive on the cross, on the stake, and then that he died later. So once they have decided this, they like to grasp at straws, mull it over their minds, think about how it might have been possible, and then from that time on lose their objectivity and refuse to admit any information into their mind which would tend to discredit their theory. What about some poignant facts from the best source you can go to, the Bible, about that question? Now, remember, the reason I say it's the best source is because the Bible is different from other books. The Bible always tells the weaknesses of its heroes and tells the strengths and the character of its villains. The Bible tells you objectively things about apostles and disciples that it's tough to believe sometimes, maybe. Except that you prove the Bible is true if you're willing to. It tells you that Peter cursed and took the name of God in vain and claimed he didn't even know Christ when they asked him, "Who are you? Are you one of his disciples?" It tells you how they all said, "Well, the jig's up, let's go home. No dice here, no soap. Forget it. They've killed him. Let's go fishing," Peter said. "Let's go back to our homes and wives and children and businesses," they said. Matthew was going back to his tax collecting. Luke was going to go back to his herbs. They were going to go back to their jobs. They thought it was all over. Now, let's just look at a few very salient facts from the Bible about the resurrection of Christ, and these are objective facts. These would have to be admitted in the realm of sheer human reason, even if you think there wasn't a God who had to do with the entire series of events. Now, if he got into the tomb, who took his body out of it? First of all, let's assume, as some people have, that it might have been his enemies. Well, that's ridiculous, isn't it? That's one of the dumbest theories you could come up with. You flunk out of sand pile if you even begin to think that. Because let's just look at it for a moment. If his enemies had stolen his body, and if he had been dead or even alive, whichever way you want to theorize about it, they would have displayed his body, alive or dead. Alive, they would have put him in a cage, displayed his body in prison, his live body, and would have tried to kill him again later. Dead, and they would have displayed his body until it would have been undisplayable anymore to try to prove to the rest of the world the whole thing was a fake. Don't let your mind reason yourself into a box canyon on that one. That is absolutely a reprehensible idea, completely insane. Did his friends steal it, as some think? The popular theory has it that his disciples knew that he wasn't dead and took his body down and secreted him away. Oh, then you think, do you, that people go out by the hundreds and eventually the thousands and they allow themselves to be burnt alive? That hurts. They allow themselves to be crucified upside down. They allow themselves to be impaled. They allow themselves to be torn asunder. They give their bodies to be burned literally, and they are martyred eventually by the hundreds of thousands for something that the entire beginning church knew was a fake and a fraud. You think for one moment, and most remember the original disciples of whom you read had tremendous persecutions. Properties lost, wives and children persecuted, themselves oftentimes, in some cases you read of it, killed brutally and mercilessly. Oh, men do this, do they, for something they know is a deliberate fraud? No, no, your mind, if it's logical at all, will not admit that. Now, what about it? Were they guilty of mass hallucination? Did they all expect Christ to rise from the dead? Well, the Bible claims that every last one of his disciples did not expect him to rise from the dead. They denied it. They said, "You're crazy," when people told them so. When people walked right alongside and he appeared to them in the garden and said, "I am Christ," they said, well, they thought he was the gardener, and they wouldn't believe it. Why, one of his disciples had to have the proof by putting his hand into the wound in his side and seeing the holes the nails made in his hands. Was it some kind of an ecstatic dream? Some weird imagination? But they didn't want to believe it. They'd departed. They'd said, "Forget it. It's all over." Well, then, how do you explain that? You can't, except that Jesus was dead and did rise. You know, I saw a program not so long ago where this thing was being discussed, and it was real interesting because it shows you the way some people reason. Here was a man that, first of all, he was trying to back one man in the corner by asking him whether or not he thought all of this could have been just explained away by pure material causes, that it could have been something about the metabolism of the body. He says, "All right, what about Lazarus? What about Christ raising Lazarus from the dead? He was dead 4 days." Now, you and I know, incidentally, I'll throw in here, that when a body is dead, it's dead. And if it's been dead 4 days, it's not one of these things where it's, quote, dead, end quote, and then comes back to life by heart massage or something else, which isn't really death, but it's just momentary cessation of one of the important functions of the body, and then it's brought back before there is real severe brain damage. Or if it isn't, well, then, of course, maybe it's too late. But any body that's been dead 4 days can be called just so much vegetable and inert material. It's just worth about, what, 92 cents, they claim. There are just so many elements and various minerals and so on there, and it's just as much vegetable as any other collection of those elements in any helter-skelter form. There's no life there. So the resurrection of Lazarus after 4 days was quite an astounding miracle, and this man was going to back the other one in the corner by saying, "All right, explain that." And then about 10 minutes later, he was saying to the same man, "Now you tell me whether or not you believe in this myth about Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden." And I thought, well, that's a switch. First of all, he backs him in the corner by showing that he can't explain away the resurrection of Lazarus. Then he turns around and denies God exists and has any power because he won't believe in Adam and Eve in the garden. Well, it shows you we reason in strange ways without God's Spirit to guide and lead. And unless or until you have absolute objectivity, which is only possible if you are willing to obey your Creator, who gives you every breath of air you breathe, and willing to obey Him and what He says, repent and be baptized and receive His Spirit and become His true child, and I don't mean in some vague happenstance either, but the definite, tangible way He commands in the Bible, then you are subject to fallible reasoning. Well, some of the most poignant facts in the Bible are that he appeared to 500 people in the same crowd at one time, and they couldn't all dream the same dream. They couldn't all have been guilty of the same sort of hallucination. Now, remember, they all considered it an idle tale. They all considered it some kind of a weird idea of just a few people. Now, what about the idea that Jesus was in some kind of a swoon? They've thought this and propounded it for years. The new furor over it is not really new, because people have thought this for centuries when they tried to reason themselves astray that he was not really dead, that he was alive in the tomb. Could he have gotten out himself singly? Well, not with that great, giant, heavy stone door before the tomb. Now, what about the records? What about the historical records? Were they tampered with? Did people just write it up and claim, well, it happened that way, and just tell a lot of lies about it? Well, remember, the records were written years and years later. The first New Testament book of the Bible wasn't written until about 50 A.D. And remember that the Gospels, Matthew, might have been written about 50, but most of them were written even later than that. And that already it had gained such momentum that 20-some years had gone by, and plenty of people had already been killed, and they were still writing about it as absolute fact. Some of the ones who were still alive and who had been there and claimed to have seen it with their own eyes. And their faith, by the way, did not rest upon written records like yours does if you prove the written records today. Their faith rested on what they had seen and heard with their own eyes and ears. It rested upon fact. It rested upon their own experience. And that's scientific. That is pragmatic. That is absolute. Because you know what you see and hear. Yes, they went about it scientifically. You can't say Thomas wasn't conducting a scientific experiment when he said, "Show me the scars." That was pretty scientific. He wanted to measure and weigh. He wanted to have it proved to himself. Well, there are plenty of more proofs. But the one big proof of all is whether or not you can explain how you came from slime, whether or not you can explain fantastic powers, energies, forces, and laws, and explain it all away without a lawgiver and a sustainer and a designer, without a creator, how you can explain life without a life giver. You need to write in for these booklets on Does God Exist? And the proof of the Bible, and get it cleared up for yourself in your own mind, and not allow other people to make up your mind for you on the most important questions in your life. Who are you? Where are you going? Where are you going to be? Are these students I quoted right? These disillusioned students who feel mankind is doomed? Or is Jesus Christ right, who says mankind is going to enter into an era so fantastic, so abundant, so filled with health and happiness your mind can't imagine it, because it's got some lessons to learn, and when he does, then we're going to live in a better world? Which would you rather believe? Ask it that way. Not that that's the important thing. Prove it to yourself. Write for these booklets. And also, you need to write for the booklet on the resurrection. When was it, and what about it? Is it true, and can you prove it? And then write for this full-color booklet on earthquakes and what science says is coming in the future, and what the Bible says about future earthquakes. Christ prophesied of them in Matthew 24. Did he know what he was talking about? This full-color booklet will send it to you by return mail as soon as you get your letter into us, and the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. It's all free of charge. There is no price. Send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. The address again in just a moment. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.